it means there are some real holes in my, you know, it's embarrassing to say, almost embarrassing to say that I have seen, I think I've seen something by John Ford.
Oh, why?
But I'm quite, I've seen The Searchers, but it was fairly recently, I have to admit.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, G. Robert.
How are you?
Good.
Well, today we're here to talk about yet another Coen Brothers film. We have, I don't know how many podcasts we've done, 30, 35? I'm not sure.
About the Coen Brothers?
Oh, no.
That would be pretty pathetic.
Yes, that would move us well into fanboy range. But today we do our third Coen Brothers film.
I think that put us in the stalker range or something. Yes, third Coen Brothers movie today.
Yeah, and the latest one, True Grit, the remake of the old John Wayne film, but this one's starring Jeff Bridges and Matt Damon. And I must admit, I went in with, I don't want to say low expectations, but I wasn't expecting, I don't know. I guess when I get the sense of someone doing a remake, it feels like it's, you know, slumming's not the word, I'm looking for. But, you know, it's not something that's going to be profound or different. And I'm not sure this one is profound or different, but I thoroughly enjoyed myself. I had a great time. I laughed a lot. And I thought it was a really great Coen Brothers film. What do you think?
I enjoyed it a lot, too. I think I know what you mean about it. Not maybe knowing that it's a remake, knowing that it's based on something that existed, it won't be a bold and pure new vision or something
right,
like that, you might
right.
think.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like when we talked about No Country for Old Men, and I know you didn't like that film quite as much as I did, but, you know, I thought that film was really trying to do something and say something. And I think there's certainly thematic elements in True Grit that are interesting, but I think what I appreciated most was just that it's a great old Western and it's got some great performances and the characters are compelling and interesting. And I never got bored and, you know, with some of the movies I saw in 2010, that's actually saying quite a bit.
Yeah. Now, were you a fan of the original?
You know, I haven't seen the original. It's one of the many movies from, you know, the 50s and 60s that are still to be seen. Have you seen the original?
No.
It's, you know, it's funny. A lot of people, when they ask me, you know, that's one of the questions they ask is, have you seen the original? And I say no. And they look at me as if, what, you haven't seen the original? And yet I don't think that's, for me, a terribly important criteria, you know, to be able to talk about a movie. I mean, obviously, one way of reading a movie is to compare it with, you know, something, you know, compare it with the book it was based on or compare it with an earlier version or compare it to other Westerns. And those readings can be enlightening and fun and versatile. But I don't think that's the only way to read a film. And I think there's I can enjoy and talk about a movie like True Grit without having to necessarily compare it as a lot of people do. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, no, I think I feel the same way. I haven't seen the original. I've seen actually very, very few Westerns. Mm. My dad loved Westerns.
Oh.
And so they were always on, you know, yeah. at my house. You know, this was back in the days when you couldn't just dial up a movie. You had to wait for it to come on. But
that's
luckily
right.
on Sunday afternoon, that's where they were. And so I almost feel like... you know, my lungs are caked with Western, but I've really only had a few puffs. And and even then I honestly didn't inhale. I mean, it means there are some real holes in my, you know, it's embarrassing to say, almost embarrassing to say that I have seen, I think I've seen something by John Ford.
Oh, why?
But I'm quite, yeah, see, I've seen The Searchers, but it was fairly recently, I have to admit. So anyway, I get a sense of Westerns, but I haven't seen them at all. And so I certainly haven't seen True Grit. I didn't know it was a John Wayne movie until you mentioned it.
Okay.
But I do agree that it doesn't invalidate someone's response to a remake, because what's interesting to me about movies is that, this is true of a lot of art, but for some reason it seems to be more true of movies, is that you bring a world of other movies into the theater with you in your head, and something about the way movies are assembled from pieces or are collaborations among lots of people, it sort of invites you to sort of be one of those people and to bring your own pieces and attach them to what you're seeing up there. It's one of the reasons that I like to talk about what a particular movie reminds me of or compare it to other movies.
Yep.
And I can see how someone who had seen the original, that would be one of those movies.
Mm-hmm.
But if you haven't seen the original, it won't be, it'll be something else, you know, and that's another interesting way to see it. And maybe sometimes it's even helpful not to have read the book.
Yeah.
It lets you see the movie for what it is, or have seen the original. It lets you see this movie for what it is.
Yep.
And it also lets you see it maybe differently from the way the filmmakers saw it, because I think we can assume the Coen brothers had the original in mind, at least fairly prominently in mind, maybe other things too, and they wanted to bring their own thing to it, maybe, of course. But since I don't, maybe I will see something completely different from them, and that's okay too. And so it's just fun to sort of the mingling of many minds is interesting.
I completely agree. You know, before we started recording, we were talking about sort of year-end stuff and top 10 lists and, you know, who won certain critics awards and the like. And that creates a certain kind of criticism in a way. In that even if people don't sort of buy into awards and all that sort of thing, I think there's still this idea of objectivity, right? Of that things have to be seen in a particular way. And I think one of the nice things about getting away from that is the understanding that when we come to a film, we of course come with our own perspectives. We come with our own backgrounds. We come with our own movies that we've seen. And that necessarily prejudices us. You know, it necessarily shapes the way we watch this film. And so when we talk about a movie, it's perfectly fine for someone to say, I loved that movie, da-da-da-da-da-da, here's why. And for someone else to say, oh, I didn't like that movie at all, and here's why, da-da-da-da-da. And it's not a question that there was a right or a wrong way of looking at that. It's like, oh, no, you were wrong. That's a great movie. I mean, we sometimes talk that way. But I think that, you know, a more nuanced or subtle way of looking at it is just to understand that we've brought our different perspectives and that, like you say, we see that movie differently because of that.
Yeah. I mean, I like a forceful defense of a movie also. But I also like to be open to someone else's ideas of, you know, if someone tells me things that they saw in a movie that I didn't think of, it's like, oh, you know, I like that. I didn't think of that. It makes me sort of reevaluate things. So it's a fun way to talk about movies.
It is. And we haven't gotten even a true great yet, but it reminds me, you know, for a long time in Chicago, it was really, I've probably mentioned this in other podcasts before, but it's really forbidden to talk about a movie right after you saw it with other critics, because apparently that was going to prejudice them or influence their review. And I always thought that was kind of strange. It was like, well, wouldn't that be a good thing? I mean, wouldn't you sort of want to have another way of looking at that? If nothing else, just to almost as a foil. I know for a while when I was doing writing, you know, back in the day, I made up this character, this foil that I called My Friend Garth. And I really enjoyed that as a foil. And often sometimes it was you, Rob, but other times it was other people that I had met and talked about a movie with and who thought about it differently than I did. And it provided a useful way, I think, to talk about or to write about a movie. So yeah.
I was surprised to find that you really do have a friend, Garth.
I do, in fact. Yes,
I thought it was completely fictional.
No, I mean, it was based on the fact that when Garth lived in Chicago, we used to go to movies a lot. And then we'd go to lunch afterwards or after dinner afterwards, and we'd talk about it. And so anyway.
You know, the dynamic you mentioned about the Chicago screening room, that where critics see the movies in Chicago, it's particularly uncomfortable because it's on the 16th floor of this office building.
Yeah.
And so as soon as you're done with a movie, you go get in an elevator with six other people, and you're all standing there silently.
No, because you don't know what else to talk about.
Yeah, right. Everybody's thinking about the movie, but you do get a sense that nobody really wants to say much. Nobody wants to commit to anything yet, I think, sometimes. Let's talk about True Grit.
Yes. Yes, everyone has turned us off by now. What did you like?
You know, I loved the language.
Yeah.
For about a third of it, it was just so dense with funny phrasings that I just wanted to play it again.
Yeah.
You know, I want to hear it. I just want to listen to it again. And it made me think that sometimes we've talked before about one of the things that I think both of us don't care for sometimes about the Coen brothers is the sort of caricature.
Right.
In particular, Southern characters or characters with thick accents.
Yeah.
So, and it's sort of... it seems like they're rubes or they're cartoons, and the Coens just love to chuckle about that.
Yeah.
A more charitable way to see that, I have to admit, would be to say that they love the sound of those voices and phrases.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly comes across that way here, where it's just the West and everybody talks this way. So there isn't one particular character. They have different voices, but they're all sort of in a stylized world.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, man, the things they come up with are so so funny. It starts with this girl. Actually, you're often better at plot summaries. Would you want to give
the... Okay, so here we have the plot. It starts, yes, this girl who's 14 years old, and her father has been gunned down by this, you know, this rascal, this no-gooder. And she's come not only to sort of take his body and send it back home, but then to track down his killer. And she is... A most precocious 14-year-old, not only in the way she talks, but in what she thinks she can accomplish. And so she sort of puts together some money through some very clever negotiating tactics. And
she's tough.
And she is a tough negotiator. We'll get to that, particularly your comments about language. But she hires a man of true grit. And that would be the Jeff Bridges or the John Wayne character. He's a U.S. Marshal, although he's also an alcoholic, and she hires him to go and track down her father's killer, who has escaped, of course, and he's off on Native American country on the reservation. And so the movie is about their relationship, but then we also have this third character, Matt Damon, who is a Texas Ranger and very proud of being a Texas Ranger. And he's been sort of tracking this or hunting this man for a while for other misdeeds. And so it's about these three and how they don't always get along, and yet how they eventually do get along.
Yeah, this girl is a fast-talking, tough negotiator, as you mentioned, and she, if she doesn't like you, she has a way of just twisting her adjectives to make them apply these little skewers to your side, your tender underbelly, as she does to Matt Damon's character. He's sort of a dandy, sort of a Texas Ranger. as soon as she spots him for the first time, and he says he just came from Arkansas, he's been pursuing Tom Chaney. She says, "We don't have any rodeo clowns in Arkansas." And then she finds he hasn't found the guy. He's also pursuing the guy that she's looking for, but he hasn't found him. And she says, "Now, why have you been ineffectually pursuing Tom Chaney?" That's an adverb, I guess. But she has a way of using each part of speech. She's so fun. And I think part of why I especially love that first third is after they sort of embark as a... her with Rooster Cogburn, that's the Jeff Bridges character, and then sometimes Matt Damon is with them or nearby. Yeah. So they're a bit of a trio out there. Once that happens, she sort of defers to Rooster more. He's mm-hmm. He's the expert out there. and so she becomes a little bit less of a character, not less of a character, but she's becomes somewhat more minor than she had been in the first third.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why that particular joy of the film wanes a little bit. But Rooster Cogburn is quite a character as well.
Yes.
And Jeff Bridges is using this voice. I don't know. It's a little bit like Quint from Jaws.
Mm.
And he's a little bit of that same kind of a salty character. Mm. It's a little bit like William S. Burroughs. he's mumbling. He's we first see him. The introduction is...
in an outhouse, right?
I guess that's true. We don't see him. We hear him first. He's in an outhouse. The first time we see him, he's giving testimony.
Oh, that's right.
And Maddie, the girl, she comes in the back, and so do we as the camera. You know, we're behind people. We can't see him very well. The light is just coming in behind him through windows, and so can't make out what's going on here. You hear this sort of mumbling, this sort of like kind of gruff voice. You don't even know it's Jeff Bridges yet, or you can guess. And it slowly creeps up to him, and you get to hear the testimony and the cross-examination too, and that's all fun. It gives you a little bit of an indication of what his character is like. But it also reminded me of Jaws. The Quint character is first introduced in a similar kind of thing, although it's backwards.
Right.
It's a town hall meeting. Everybody's gathered. Oh, they're all talking about the shark and what to do. And all of a sudden there's this screech in the back of the room of somebody's fingernails. And there's Quint. "I'll catch a shark for you." You know?
You all know me, know how I earn a living. I'll catch this bird for you, but it ain't gonna be easy. It's bad fish. Not like going down the pond chasing bluegills or tommy cods. This shark, swallow you whole. Shaking, tenderizing, down you go. And we gotta do it quick. I don't bring back the tourists, I'll put all your businesses on a paying basis. But it's not going to be pleasant. I value my neck a lot more than $3,000, Chief. I'll find him for three, but I'll catch him and kill him for 10. And you got to make up your minds. You want to stay alive and ante up? You want to play it cheap? Be on welfare the whole winter. I don't want no volunteers. I don't want no mates. There's too many captains on this island. $10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Quint. We'll take it under advisement.
Yes, that's America off Jersey coast. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no cause for alarm. We have a minor problem in the boiler room, but everything is now under sound effects of a nuclear blast. Explosion splits the boat. Dr. Benway's ship's doctor drunkenly added 2 inches to a 4-inch incision with one stroke of his scalpel. Perhaps the appendix is already out, doctor, the nurse said, and peering dubiously over his shoulder. I saw a little scar. The appendix already out. I'm taking the appendix out. What do you think I'm doing here? Perhaps the appendix is on the left side, doctor. That happens sometimes, you know. Stop breathing down my neck, I'm coming to that. Don't you think I know where an appendix is? I studied appendectomy in 1904 at Harvard. Lifts the abdominal wall and searches along the incision, dropping ashes from his cigarette. Get me a new scalpel. This one's got no edge to it.
Can we depart this afternoon?
We? You are not going. That is no part of it.
Well, you have misjudged me if you think I'm silly enough to give you $50 and watch you simply ride off.
I'm a bonded U.S. Marshal.
That weighs but little with me. I will see the thing done.
I've been the duck. I can't go after Ned Pepper and a band of hard men look after a baby at the same time.
I am not a baby.
Won't be stopping at boarding houses where there's warm beds and hot grub on the table. I'll be traveling fast, eating light. A little sleeping is done to take place on the ground.
Well, I have slept out at night before. Papa took me a little Frank Coon hunting last summer on the Petit Jean. We were in the woods all night. We sat around a big fire and yarn all told ghost stories. We had a good time.
Coon hunting? This ain't no coon hunt.
Same kind of thing of the salty character.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's great. It's and one of the things that's fun for me is that Jeff Bridges is somehow never not funny in this movie. He's a serious character, and yet because of that sort of, you know, his use of language and because of the way he talks and the way he likes to needle Matt Damon's character, of course. But he's sort of charmed by the girl and yet frustrated by the girl, and so he enjoys the battle of wits that he has with her at times, or the battle of language that he has with her. And it's three characters. Matt Damon's character is not quite as important, but even still, it's three great characters. And yeah, you're right that the girl becomes somewhat less important as the movie goes on, which is maybe a bit of a shame, because she's maybe the best of the three, I think, just as far as how the characters are drawn. But it was just delightful to be with them from beginning to end. And, you know, it's often this, you know, we're recording here in mid-January. It's often true to, you know, you think about the last year. We evaluate 2010, and I haven't heard anyone say that 2010 was a good year for movies.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, you know, horrible narratives and stupid characters and ridiculous special effect contrivances. And so how really gratifying it is to see a movie with not one, not two, but three sort of interesting characters that you get to spend the whole movie with.
Yeah. And it remains that way to the end. Mm-hmm. The end is constructed in a way that they really are the three legs of a stool, which is a really satisfying way that it all locks mm-hmm. together. I won't give any of that away, but it's fun.
Yeah.
There is a serious side to this movie. I don't think it's quite the philosophical treatise that, you know, you could say a serious man is, or even that some people think No Country for Old Men is. Yeah. But there is the same structure in some ways that we've seen in a lot of Coen Brothers movies, where there are people pursuing doggedly something, leaving a trail of blood.
Right.
And this thing somehow seems less important by the end, or and the journey seems absurd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The movie opens, as many Coen Brothers do, with this sort of inner title, but in this case, it's a quotation from the Book of Proverbs. You know, and it says, you know, the wicked flee when none pursueth. And as with many Coen Brothers inner titles, you're not sure how seriously to take that. You don't know at the beginning of the film whether that we should consider that. How much cynicism underlies that quotation, shall we say. But for me, one of the an even more interesting line of dialogue early on in the film comes from the girl acts as a narrator, particularly at the beginning of the movie and the end of the movie. And she has a, not only is she a tough negotiator, but she has a very, very strong sense of right and wrong. This is the right thing, this is the wrong thing. And it's not quite clear where she gets this idea of right and wrong, but it's very, very definite in her own mind. And she has a line, she says, "Nothing is free except for the grace of God." And I thought that was an interesting line, because it's amazing how much of the movie involves negotiations, and negotiations about things and or money, and sometimes both. And that sense of everything having a price, or everything having a sense of worth attached to it or not attached to it, I think is a really important theme in the film. But like you say, as the movie goes on, that becomes less important when in the end, and we'll try our best not to give anything away, but the idea of worth leaves, I think. And this idea of sacrifice becomes sort of a greater theme. And what are you willing to sort of sacrifice and not thinking about what it's worth? And I think that transition is an interesting one. And I found it provided me a lot of thought after the movie.
Yeah, and it's very smooth too. It's not like it takes a sharp turn.
No.
And it's not like it reaches a point where it's sort of loses you into this new theme that you didn't really care for. It's just sort of it's organic.
Yeah.
It comes out of what's happening.
Yeah.
Early on, there's a scene in a cabin that ends with, you know, a couple of people dead.
Yeah.
And Hattie notes that. You can see her sort of looking at them, and then so the camera lingers on that too. Yeah. And we're aware that there is a body count piling up here, and that, you know, there must be some point at which this is just, maybe we've passed it already, but even in a Western, there will reach a point where this is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And she seems to be considering that same thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned her sense of right and wrong, and that she has this very clear sense of how the world works. In a lot of ways, it's a very bookish. She's a hard negotiator, but you get the sense that she hasn't negotiated in this sort of climate before, and she expects that, you know, having a good lawyer, or threatening that you're going to see. she mentions that she has a good lawyer several times, and one person says, "What I need is a good judge." it's a sort of book learning, but not necessarily a lot of, you know, she's been coon hunting, and he says, "Well, this is no coon hunt." it is similar to a coon hunt, she insists. That is pretty, it's basically the same thing.
And then at some point says, "Well, this has turned into a turkey shoot."
Right. So she's not quite like, there's the Peter Bogdanovich movie, Paper Moon, where there's sort of a young girl who seems wise beyond her, or, you know, somehow adult-like.
Right.
She's not that. She's not smoking. She's not that kind of a character. No. She's more like Sarny in Nightjohn, where Sarny was a slave and had a mentor named Nightjohn who was sort of, but somehow she was also kind of superhuman, and it makes the film so rewarding, because you get to see her give people their comeuppance because she's so smart. She's just sharp. And I think that's what part of the appeal of the Hattie character in this movie too.
Yeah, I agree. We can't overlook Roger Deakins' cinematography, which is great as always. I mean, you know, what he's doing, particularly like with light browns, it's really, really beautiful shot Western. There's some silhouettes that are almost breathtaking in their beauty. And so it's, and the ending is a bit, I don't know how to describe it, but it's, I found it really lovely in the way it's shot. So,
yeah, there are some vistas. You know, I was thinking about how there are some vistas in the movie that are just beautiful on a wide screen. But it's the kind of thing And this doesn't take anything away from True Grit, but it's almost like the way stunts and special effects have become devalued by the ubiquity of digital effects. Mm-hmm. You know, things that used to be impossible are now so easy that mm-hmm. we take them for granted, and they didn't really have a stunt person do that because they just erased the lines or whatever right. that he was hanging from or whatever. Yeah. And in some ways, that's true of these just simple vistas, because it used to be that you had to find this spot that had no power lines and no roads mm-hmm. if you wanted to shoot something that takes place in 1850 or whatever, right, you know? Right. And here they found it. Where did they find this? I almost wonder, is this New Zealand? Where is this? Where yeah. can you, even in Wyoming, where can you find this particular shot? Mm. And then I have to remind myself, well, maybe they didn't. Maybe they erased those yeah. lines. Regardless, it looks great. And I would actually like to know where it's shot. Do you know?
I don't. No, I don't. But yeah, it feels... in a classic Western, maybe I've seen a few more Westerns than you have, although certainly no authority, but it feels like it's tapped into that sense of, you know, old John Ford Westerns, or, you know, sort of, you know, where nature isn't the antagonist here. It's not although at the end it becomes, but there's it's a part of the story, and beautifully a part of the story, I think.
There's also, I have seen The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, mm. comes to mind, because there's this sort of money theme yeah. and the whole double-crossing kind of thing that is fun to watch. And also the sort of dogged pursuit of, and the yeah. absurd pursuit for some object, some thing, some retribution, something that seems outside of your normal life
right.
Is definitely here. I also thought of Dead Man, Jim Jarmusch's yep. Western. It's a Western, but it's very different from, you could say that True Grit is sort of a modern Western, but Jarmusch's movie is like a deconstructed Western or something. It's like doesn't function like a Western typically would,
right.
where True Grit does.
Yeah.
But there were these moments where Rooster and Hattie are just sort of riding two horses through trees. A particular shot, actually, a particular scene, a series of shots, reminded me of when Johnny Depp and is it Gary Farmer?
I think that's right.
Okay, are doing the same thing in Dead yeah. Man, and there's just this idle chit chat that's very funny, mm-hmm. and and Cogburn in this movie is talking about his ex-wives and just sort of chit chat, yeah. even if they're finding a man hanging from a tree, even if yeah. she's shinnying up at this giant tree to cut down the man from a noose, you know, he's still talking about his ex-wife, and it was sort of like the Native American character in Dead Man, mm-hmm. who's always talking about the sort of the mm-hmm. absurdity of
yeah, that's nice.
Culture.
I like that.
And Robbie Mueller's cinematography, although it was black and white, in Dead Man there was these trees, just these, you know, perfectly straight, almost like poles mm-hmm. that they're riding among, mm-hmm. shows up in True Grit as well. It's mm-hmm. just a very cinematic, three-dimensional
yeah.
space that they're moving through. It's really cool.
Mm. Yeah, that's nice.
One other thing I wanted to mention was that the editor, if you watch the credits at the end of this movie, is Roderick James. But people who know the Coen brothers know that that's actually a pseudonym for the Coen brothers. Mm. And it's actually pretty rare for major filmmakers to be the primary editors of their films. But I always think that it'd be nice if you saw that more often, because mm-hmm. especially in a movie like this, or comic scenes yeah. or suspenseful scenes, the editing is everything.
Yeah.
And you might have written these lines, you might have performed these lines, but it's the editor who's going to pace them. Mm-hmm. And so it underscores their talent, I think, each of those. They, you know, they directed the actors to read their dialogue, and then they put it together in the end. I think that's why it often feels so punchy.
Yeah, this isn't a comic scene, but for me, one of the most best edited parts of the movie is the nighttime scene where Jeff Bridges' character and the girl come upon this little shack, and they're tracking you know, their prey, so to speak, but he's not there. But these guys that they do meet seem somewhat fishy. And the conversation between the four characters, I thought, was really brilliantly put together. As sort of revealing various things, you know, some of it's people talking, sometimes it's reaction shots, and I think you're exactly right. It really, the editing contributes to what they're doing and the vision that they have.
Yeah, definitely. I interviewed Gus Van Sant a few years ago mm-hmm. and asked him about this, because he edited his more recent movies, like Elephant and, yeah. and the smaller, sort of more experimental movies, but he didn't edit Good Will Hunting.
Okay.
And this was before Milk. And I asked him about that, like, why don't more filmmakers edit? Because I always look for that, and I always appreciate that when mm-hmm. I see his name listed there. And he said that, you know, it's the, those movies, for in his case, they were simpler. You know, there aren't that many shots in Jerry, for example.
Yeah, right.
So it was easy for him to do. And also just that aesthetically, it seemed like that was what he was trying to do. Mm-hmm. He's the one who knew what he wanted to do in that case.
Yeah.
But also that it's like anything, art direction, for example. You can't do everything in a movie, and so you end up delegating it.
Yeah.
And it does make sense for the director to oversee that, but that it also makes sense in big, complicated projects to delegate it to people. And that in some cases, for political reasons, that can be advantageous to have someone else to carry some of the burden.
Okay.
And that he might do that in his next movie because it's fairly big. And it was Milk, and he did. It was he was not the editor on Milk, so there can be some savviness involved there too.
Interesting. Was he meaning it in the way that if you have two people advocating for something, it's more likely to be approved by the powers that be?
Could be, maybe so. Or that there's someone else to blame if something doesn't come out just exactly right, you know? It's almost like, it's a smart business move. And maybe the Coens have enough clout at this point and skill, frankly, that they...
Well, there are two of them.
So. There you go. Makes perfect sense.
Anything else that stand out to you about the film?
You mentioned the ending, and I don't want to talk too much about the ending because it's nice and it's sort of delicate and it sort of just stands on its own. But I will say that when Hattie meets the Matt Damon character early on, it's sort of antagonistic, but before the scene is over, it almost feels like a meet cute.
Mm-hmm.
That you could imagine that in certain Hollywood movies, these two are going to end up together,
right,
and by the end we're going to cheer that or something. Right. And I was hoping that wouldn't be the case. And that's not that I even expect that from the Coen brothers, but I just sort of, it made me think, even as the movie was going, this is a movie that follows a basic Hollywood classical structure, story, everything that you would expect sort of happens. And yet, don't they detach from that a little bit in ways that don't violate the story, don't like deconstruct it or wreck it? It is still that, but somehow they bring it to their own conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is that the meet cute doesn't turn out to have been that.
Right. It's interesting.
It could have been very easily. And they even make a point of that in the end.
They do. It's the fact that I know a little bit about both the book and the movie, or the original, informs this. Maybe this sort of betrays our earlier conversation.
No, I was curious. Yeah.
It's the original movie apparently has a much happier ending. Not necessarily in romance, but in other ways. But apparently the way this version of True Grit mirrors the book exactly. In other words, the way the book ends is how this movie ends. And so in that sense, the Coen brothers is much more faithful to the book than the original movie was.
It's harder to imagine an ending like this working that well in the 50s or 60s. You know?
But I think you're exactly right, though, that and one of the things that I find really appealing about this film is it has a very sort of classic Hollywood narrative structure. And to see it done well is very satisfying. For me, the film has almost no dead points. I mean, I was involved emotionally and almost from beginning to end. And that's just not very true of movies for me anymore. Even sort of arty films that I tend to like, I saw the Sofia Coppola Somewhere last night. And while there's a lot to recommend, there's also some points where it's like, what the heck is this doing here? And, whereas I don't think I had that experience at all in True Grit. And part of it was how satisfyingly constructed the narrative is.
Yeah. And to circle back to one thing I said about their previous movie, Burn After Reading, it's always the case that their plots lock together tightly, and that's so appealing about the way they put their movies together. But sometimes, and Burn After Reading for me was one of those times, it really helped them that some of the characters were really stupid.
Right.
And did things that didn't make any sense.
Yep.
And it undercuts the whole idea of something fitting together perfectly if you had to like bend the jigsaw pieces to get them to fit, you know? Where this wasn't the case. They're crazy. They may be kind of crazy sometimes, but they behave logically and they do things that you'd expect and things don't come out of the blue.
Yeah. And even the bad guys behave logically.
Yeah.
You know, which again rarely happens in Hollywood movies anymore. Usually the bad guy has to have some long speech where, you know, that becomes his downfall. But Barry Pepper, who I've come to really like as an actor, plays not the main villain, but maybe even a more important villain in the end of the movie. And he's great. And he has some really great lines but he acts in ways that I think are very reasonable and logical. And, And that makes the movie's conclusion that much more interesting.
Yeah, it makes it more of a game of wits, too. Yeah. If you believe that it's not even necessarily that there are good guys and bad guys, it's just everyone has their interests.
Yes.
And yeah. they all have their interests. And if you can figure out what that guy's interests are, you can figure out how to play them into yours.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. Yes, I did pronounce Matty Ross's name Hattie multiple times in this discussion. Thank you for noticing. If you'd like to spot more mistakes, you can find more episodes where you found this one, or for instance at our home on the web, dailyplastic.com, where every single day there is no new content. Or search for us on iTunes, put in Plastic Podcast and we'll pop up. We'll be back sooner than you think to talk about another remake of a classic American Western. It's called Black Swan, starring Natalie Portman. I promise you that when I hear Tchaikovsky, I can see Monument Valley in my head. We'll talk more then. Bye.
Show me the way to go home. I'm tired and I want to go to bed. I had a little drink about an hour ago, and it's gotten right to my head. Well,